Good morning. Thank you for coming today. I'm continuing down a road I've probably been doing for about 3 or 4 months, which is most koans, again, are done from expressions that people have brought up in terms of practice. And, you know, basically it's the same today. Doesn't have to be like the old masters said, but a live practice is the most important thing, whatever's going on now. So if you have any questions that you'd like to bring up, or any koans that are going on for you, please bring them up. We can address them. If not, I'll talk about something else. Well, no, I mean, I'm not talking about a case koan. I'm talking about questions, basically, deeper questions. They don't have to be, you know, from somebody else.
Okay. I was just wondering how it's perceived to keep my eyes closed during meditation. I tend to want to do that. Mm-hmm. I know that's not practice, but I want to, for these short periods, 30 minutes, I want to keep my eyes closed.
Yeah. Yeah, and again, you know, it's your experiment. There's several things that I've noticed through practice. One of them is if I keep my eyes wide open, then there's a lot of input that's coming in. If I keep them closed, it's a bit more quiet. But then there's a tendency towards sleepiness that comes in. And also, in the long run, if you keep your eyes, say, half, you know, they say sort of keep them, you know, your eyes lowered. And if I do that, then I'm still receptive to input, but at the same time, there's an experience, a feeling that's going on inside. The reason that it tends to be emphasized in our own tradition is that eventually it stops that division between Zazen and everyday life, because the same eyes that see while we're doing things are the same ones that sit.
I see.
So in time it does that. But, you know, in saying that, sometimes I keep my eyes closed.
Okay.
Especially if I'm really tired, but, you know, then. You know, then it's sort of... Yeah. Anyone else? Yeah.
I find the thing I've been working through the most over the last few months is really that right livelihood side of things.
Mm-hmm. How do you see right livelihood?
Being able to meet your responsibilities, but not doing it in a way that sends bad effects out.
Yeah. Into the world, yeah, that's good. Yeah.
But the thing that I struggle with is I'm in a job where what I do, it's useful, it kind of serves a purpose, but so much of the day-to-day is just kind of washing bottles and sorting buttons kind of thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's that sort of repetitive kind of mind-numbing activity. And that's kind of what I keep struggling with, is how to adjust to that.
Yeah, I mean, that's a tough one.
Yeah, I guess it's that there's things that matter and there's things that don't.
Mm-hmm.
And life is always going to have some of each, but it just feels like I spend so much time doing things that just really don't matter.
Mm-hmm.
And they give me a paycheck and provide some services and things. It's accounting work, but yeah, it's that mindless aspect of so many of these things. And I keep asking myself if I'm in the right line of work or need to be doing something else. And it's,
yeah, and to remember that's those are valid questions. You know, how do you want to live? How do you want to, you know, because if you're not living in a way that you really want to live, is that you're going to have to address that at some point. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's the overview. It's like for me with doing things is that, you know, especially around here, I do certain things that I've done over and over. And I take it as an art. I try and bring a sense of art into it, of, you know, really being imminent. not telling myself the story, well, I've done this 10,000 times, etc., but bring an art to it. But then in the long run is, are you really fulfilling your own aspirations? You know, and is there a way of fulfilling those things? You know, you can do that either by evaluating your own way that you live, and then you can also do and making those changes, or you can try something else too. You know, but I mean, there's always a risk with that kind of thing too,
yeah.
as you know.
Can backfire sometimes.
Well, yeah, and that risk may be worth taking that risk. Did you want to say something to... No, I thought you had a insight into that. But it's, you know, I mean, again, it's your life, and that's the important thing in terms of, say, practice and appreciating one's life, is that however you live, that's the only life that you have. You know, so it's important to try and raise the value of that, apply the awareness that you have to anything. Try not to get it in your own head, you're trapped, and this is the way it always is. It's important to open up to a situation and look and see what's actually there and how you can move through it.
Yeah, it kind of has the feel right now. Kind of has a feeling it's one of those transitional periods in life.
Yeah.
I got out of a really rough line of work that I didn't like, and I have a much better situation now, but it's still just not to that point where it's like, I'm happy to do what I do.
Yeah.
The 10 hours that I do it, it's still kind of getting there, I guess. But it's...
Yeah, and then again, look at what you're bringing to the situation, what you're adding to it to make it worse. You know, because quite often we develop a mindset around it.
Yeah.
You know, either from what people say about that kind of work, or, you know, a person like me shouldn't be fill in the blank, rather than, well, if I'm doing this, how do I do that to the best of my ability? Turn it into an art and develop my own, you know, way of being through these things. Because there's always going to be repetitive stuff in life. But then it's how we use those, you know, those times.
Yeah. I think that's a lot of what I struggle with, is that I do bring a lot of the, you know, why am I doing this? What am I doing here? Kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And probably some of it's justified, some of it probably isn't. But it's,
yeah, experiment with it. You know, it's worthwhile doing. You know, doing that is. You know, I often hear people go, "Well, a person like me shouldn't be doing this," and I go, "Well, what are you actually doing? Well, if you're doing it, how do you make the best of it?" You know, and obviously there's the other part, which is if you feel you can make some changes, make some changes. But then if you practice bringing in that, you know, self-criticism or the criticism of the job, is that that's what you're actually practicing.
Mm. Yeah.
So you can take a load off yourself and just do it, and then just learn how you can make it into an art. And you will learn some stuff from doing that. Then obviously the second thing is make those changes if you can.
Yeah, it's always hard to know how much of it is the just general dissatisfaction that goes with being human, and how much of it is...
Well, again, that's a tool. You know, that very dissatisfaction is the Bodhi mind. If you just let it stay on the level of dissatisfaction, then it just disturbs your own consciousness. Now, if you see, well, I'm dissatisfied with this, and this, what can I do to change it? Then you begin to turn that stuck axle. You know, where it says life is suffering, or this one here is a stuck axle wheel, it begins to work in a positive way. That's how you use it, that dissatisfaction. It's not just a negative.
Yeah.
It's the same energy that actually turns for the better as well.
Yeah. Do something good with it.
Yeah. Yeah, see if you can. You know, that's the process. Don't just take my word for it. It's just see if that's the process. Yeah, you know, and talking about work and things like that, I remember... when Nick was about 3, I'd take him on the rock wall behind the house, and we'd put rocks in concrete, and it was great, you know. And then maybe a year later, his brothers told him that it was that was work. And so he never did it again. But you know, you know, we do the same thing. Don't think that because he's a kid, he's not sophisticated. We take things on about things.
Yeah, the world is one-fourth world and three-fourths mind.
Well, you know, whatever proportion you want. But the thing is to work through those things so you're actually free to do those when it's necessary, and you're free to do other things when not. You know, that freedom needs to go in both ways. Because, you know, like sometimes the center is I'm doing stuff I've done thousands of times. I'm just doing the same old thing. But then if I start telling myself that, I wouldn't be here, you know. But actually the doing of it and turn it into an art, whatever it is, because it's my life, not because of the idea. If I do something, then I want to enjoy it as much as I possibly can. So then looking at the things, how I spoil it, weeding those things out, you know. But there's options, you know, that's one of the main things. But this practice in daily life is a question that you know, I've been dealing with, that my teacher's been dealing with, that, you know, I went back to England last week to do a session there, and it's still one of the major steps in this country that really has to be accepted. Whatever we do with our own minds is practice, you know, so might as well do those things that make positive changes in terms of one's life. I realized that I've been talking about practicing daily life to the English and the few Scots and that were there, and said I've been doing this for 21 years, you know, and then so I said, will you do me a favor? And they go, oh, sure, okay. Will you take practice into daily life for this next year, you know, until I get back next time? They're saying, okay, raise your hands. How many of you will do it? About half, just half of them, you know, raise their hand. And I said, come on, you know, you're always asking these questions. Why don't you do it? So one of the ladies who's just across the way, she just said, well, I'll aspire to do it. I said, don't aspire to it. Just do it. Get the head out of the way and just do it, you know. But the thing is, that's where the rubber meets the road in terms of practice. If you're really greedy, you want practice 24/7 or realization. So that's the bridge that really has to be, you know, made there, is that how do I practice now? Wherever you stand with kids, with work, whatever place that you stand, that's practice in daily life. Now, in terms of, like you talked about right livelihood, that's something like the fifth, I think, in the, you know, in the eightfold path. So see things as they are, intend to do it. Right speech or right commitment, actually right action, do it. And the fifth one then is right livelihood. Now that right livelihood is actually the extension of right action or doing something in all spheres of life. You know, relationship, hanging out, work, raising the family. But it's making that attempt. Don't think that it should be complete or it's going to look a certain way or you're always going to feel content. That's not the process. You know, that's not the reality of the process. Sometimes it's very hard to actually do that. But the more you try it, the more you develop an inner ethic that helps to steer you through whatever it is that you're doing and stops you falling into things that go against that basic inner ethic that's there. It doesn't mean that, you know, you go to a party and you cross your legs and you sit in Zazen. You know, it's that you look at ways that you can affect, say, the people around you. You can, you know, enjoy it even, you know, heaven forbid. And so you begin to enliven your own life. You know, you don't just take on these beliefs, well, practice occurs here, and then it doesn't occur in these other places. And, you know, quite frankly, sometimes it's very difficult. I remember after about four or five nights of you know, waking up in the night to change baby diapers, which some of you understand, you know, it's like, I can't do this anymore, you know. But, well, why? What's practice meant to look like? You know, right now, I'm practicing with very deep fatigue. You know, so what do you expect? So then it's just enlightening the situation that you're in, whatever it is, and seeing what can be taken care of, what is to be done. What does practice look like? Return to that being over and over and over. It doesn't mean that you have to always feel like you're, you know, you're really practicing, you're really putting all your energy into it, because sometimes there's no energy there. How do you practice when you're sick? All of these things. It doesn't need to look like a particular thing that practice is, but as long as you're making that effort to be present in your own life and receiving the teachings that are coming in from the universe in whatever way, then that's what practicing daily life is. And the thing that occurs over a period of time is that you begin to see you couldn't be in another time or another place. It's never going to look like somebody else's life, you know. It's never going to look like the archetypal monk, you know, sitting under the Bodhi tree or whatever, you know. And even if you did sit under the Bodhi tree, it still wouldn't look like somebody else's life, you know. The thing is that you have a unique opportunity. Nobody has been you in this entire universe throughout space and time. So this is your opportunity to practice in whatever way is in your own inner ethic. And then to live that, you know, and then to live that out. That's the opportunity that we have. The Zazen is like a cornerstone. The way that, actually I like the word facade better. You know, so you go to, you know, a place at Universal Studios or whatever, and you open the door, and instead of finding a room in there, you know, it's like the entire lot's there, the sky's there, the universe is there. Zazen is very much like that. You sit still on the cushion, and then you actually see what's going on, because you're doing nothing else. You know, not only do you see the inner workings of the human being, physical, psychological, emotional, but you also see the interaction of the senses and the sense sphere, which is also your life as well. All of those things come in terms of Zazen. And in time, that really sinks in. It's not just a matter of me. You know, everything is practicing in one way or another as my life on a momentary basis, through and through. And the beauty of Zazen, again, is that it's very difficult to delude yourself over a period of time. I'm not saying it's impossible, you know, but if something's there, that's exactly what you see. You've got an opportunity to deal with it there. It's, you know, it's very good. A lot of people say, well, I meditate better in the woods or this and that. Well, that's fine. If you're in the woods, then meditate that way. When you're in the middle of a city or whatever, how do you really meditate? Or what is life in itself? That goes on no matter where you are. The one who sees through these eyes is always awake and aware, whether you like it or not. And again, that's the thing that you're practicing. It's not meant to look like something, you know. I'm stopping at that point in case you have any questions or comments.
Roshi.
Yeah.
Being a resident here and a member of the training period, the word training, people are asking, what are you training now to be? You know, last year was a disciple, the year before was a Hare Krishna, and what is it now? So I haven't been able to answer that yet. What are we training for? I feel like I'm just practicing what we've learned.
Yeah, I mean, that's, yeah, training, practicing. You can use either one. You know, it's funny. Obviously, one of the major things we have to do is do that translation in our own minds from whatever, you know, we read from, say, Buddhism, and then the application of that is the most important thing, and then the refining of that. It's like in there's a statement of Master Dogen's which sort of encapsulates the whole of Zen practice, which goes, to study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be enlightened by the 10,000 things and drop off the minds of self and others and to continue this traceless enlightenment endlessly. So the whole of practice is in that. But the way that it's translated is to study. There's certain implications with the word study. This word study can also mean to practice. So that's kind of interesting. Now, Some people sort of go, well, how do you practice the self? That's what we do. So he goes, to practice the Buddha way is to practice the self. To practice the self is to forget the self. Okay, now what it is to practice the self, it doesn't mean selfish things, but the self is made up of far more than what we regard as, say, ego or, say, selfish activities. The self includes our environment. Again, when have you ever woken up and the world not been there? You know, what makes you so alienated or isolated from the rest of this world? Because it's always showing up, always supporting us. I've never woken up in, you know, vast empty space, trying to find a place to land. The earth is supports us 24/7. The sky, you know, gives us light, and the sun never goes, I'm having a bad day. I'm going to stay over here in the east. I'm not coming out. I'm not coming out till people start treating me better. You know, comes across. But, you know, it's funny, but at the same time, when do we really recognize the world is there? Always supports us. Always supports me, I, on a momentary basis. To study the Buddha way is to study the self. So that part is very important. Or the practice the Buddha way is to practice the self. To really be in this place. And in seeing that, you see that all the things that arise, this thing that we regard as a continuity of I, isn't really that. It's the arising of all kinds of things. And what is our biggest experience is our universe, our world. Universe is a bit bigger word for me. It sounds a bit cosmic. But world's big enough. It's a good enough thing. You know, the world is the biggest part of my life. It's not the stuff that goes on in my head and how I self-define. That's the stuff that causes me the problems. You know, the sun's shining and going, well, I'm having a bad day today. You know, people are not treating me right. You know, I didn't get the money that I wanted. And the sun's shining, you know, the trees are glistening. Even in LA, I remember, you know, I'd bring up those thoughts like that, and I'd look up and there's the skyscrapers and the reflected sun off the skyscrapers and the palm trees. There's beauty everywhere. And yet we get stuck, or I get stuck in my own ideas of how the world is. You know? So that aspect of practicing over and over, we learn about the world. And in learning about the world, the self-centeredness begins to drop off. It just becomes more of a tool when it's necessary. You know, it may be a funny thing for you, but sometimes it's like, you know, you need to put those boundaries in. Those are good boundaries every now and then. But they become more of a tool rather than a dominant feature of one's own life. Any questions up to this point or comments? Yeah.
I've been participating in the training period and...
You've been leading it.
And really, really, really enjoying it. Really, mm-hmm. whatever job I get, if I'm painting, if I'm cleaning, or cooking, it's okay. If the schedule, mm-hmm. whatever the schedule is, it's okay. So as the training period is coming to an end, I was getting anxious.
Yeah.
About like this kind of contentment. Can I experience that when I'm not here?
Yeah.
So I was talking with Jokai Sensei about that while you were gone, and I said, I know what my Zumi Roshi would say, just do it.
Yeah.
And Jokai said, yeah, but he didn't mean just do it in 2 weeks when it's over. He just do it now, and that will take care of what happens later. And it really helped me.
Yeah.
It seems obvious now when I say it out loud, but this idea, anyway.
Yeah. No, it's important. You know, I mean, that's that application. At this moment in time, over and over, and it begins to sink in. You know, it's like my Zumi Roshi would say, you know, just this is it, and really see the content of this, you know. And I would sort of say to myself, yeah, it's okay for you saying that, you're enlightened. You know, then one day it sunk in through doing it over and over. And as human beings, we forget that aspect, is that we seem to do better by repeating things over and over until they sink in. If we just do them every now and then, they tend to get forgotten. They don't get embodied. And it's that embodiment that then makes them accessible at any time. You know, and that's what places like this are about, is you have no choice. It's just, you show up, you face up to it. And then eventually something, you know, gives, and it's obvious, and you just carry on doing it. It doesn't even need to be worked out in your head, you know. You just do it, and it's taken on. And I was sort of reflecting on this aspect of especially traditional practices, that you do something and you keep on doing it, then you realize something. But if you, you know, again, so much of it is an embodiment in that way. It's like with service, a lot of people don't appreciate it, but over time is that you begin to see that affects other parts of your life. All you're doing is you're moving your body in certain ways, you know. So when you go outside, you know, what's the difference between this and this or this? You know, you're just moving the meat puppet in one way or another, and it's not, you know, it's not a big deal. That's practice. But then the ideas that we bring into that about, well, this is beneath me or whatever. Well, what are you doing now? Oh, I'm doing this. Okay, well, let's just do that to the best of my ability. Why? Because it's my life. You know, but people quite often expect a reward. You know, so when I die, I've got my own planet. Got that going for me, you know. Personally, I would rather have the contentment of being alive now than something that somebody's promising me later, because, you know, government might get hold of it and go, well, planet's not yours. There's a legal battle going on. And I'd be very disappointed, you know. But, I mean, you laugh about it, but... So I remember a friend of mine, his auntie's son died before him. And, you know, she'd been a Catholic nun, and... she completely lost faith in the religion simply because that shouldn't happen. But who knows what happens in life? The important thing is, how do I deal with this? And how can I practice those things that are most valuable to me, you know, now, and make them live as my own life / practice? You know, then you always have that much. It doesn't need to be complete. I keep saying that. It's that I don't know what completion is. On one level, I'm complete as I am. But at the same time, there's much, much more to do. I mean, I can use, what the Buddha said to do that. You know, he says in the Heart Sutra that most people that stay here chant on a daily basis, where he goes, gate, gate, paragate, parasangate, bodhisvaha, which is going, going, gone beyond, always going on beyond the other shore, svaha. So basically it's that whatever you realize, put into practice, throw it away. Move on. Meet whatever challenge is there. Feel confident in yourself in that process. And the last word, that svaha, is just whoopee. You know? Yeah, I mean, seriously, that's what they say. Whoopee. Why? Because another day in paradise. Well, whatever you want to call it. Yeah.
One of the sort of the experience that I've been having recently is that I notice how I put in all these limitations. Mm-hmm. I have these thoughts. I feel negatively. Maybe depression comes up. But then I notice that I can let that go and return to what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And really immerse myself. And that's a great freedom, and it's a beautiful thing. My daily life, though, it feels like I open up to what I'm doing, and then I just notice how I get narrow. And yeah. It's a bit crazy-making these days for me, mm-hmm. because it's just like, mm-hmm. I really notice it. As soon mm-hmm. as it starts to happen, it's just like, you know, lockdown. And then I can respond mm-hmm. and move into like a deeper connection with what I'm mm-hmm. doing, with all of life, with the sky. It's really wonderful, mm-hmm. but then you know.
Yeah.
And that's just what I'm going through.
Yeah.
So I wanted to share that and see if you had anything to.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, you know, for me nowadays is that most of the stuff I work out in my body, I try not to create a story around it, and then I try and push the limits of that, you know, especially if it's the negative stuff. And I also try not to go, well, this is mine, and this is theirs. I try not to draw those barriers or boundaries there. So whatever's being processed, let it process. And in that process, I try things. I try different things. You know, for me, it's the depression or... You know, thing. I don't know what another word for it is an opportunity for me to go to my depths, because for me that's the only way through depression. It's just really to go into the depths of whatever's there, and then I learn something that's applicable to all the other aspects of my life. But in that process, it's also allowing that to occur. I don't need to create a story around it, because the story usually just locks me into something. It's just like experience that, and then in time that gets worn out. And a lot of the things that occur in my life, I have no idea what they are. You know, and then I allow that function of the wheel. I use that analogy, the stuck axle wheel. To work through it, because I know it's only got a certain season. That season may be a long season, but I know that in time I'll work through it. But again, it's not just working through it in my head, it's experientially. Am I doing it for myself? Am I doing it for others? That's also irrelevant. It's just do it. Just let it occur. And in time, you know, some things you'll learn compensation, how to compensate for those things. Other things you'll learn about your own biorhythms. You know, and in that process, it's a tremendous learning experience. But the main problem is the definition of whatever it is that you're going through, and then the fixing of that, rather than the pushing against the limitations wherever those things come up. Is this true? It can even be physically. Is this true? And in doing so, is that you find out if it is true. If it's true, then that's what occurs. If it's not, you find ways of working through these things. You know, it's like me and the heart arrhythmia, is that I keep on pushing against those things. And I know if I take it beyond a certain point, it takes me about 3 or 4 days to recover from it. But I'm not going to just go and sit back and just go, well, I'm not going to do anything now. You know, is I want to find out about how that really works in various scenarios, and then I'm more prepared to face up to that in life in whatever way. And then, you know, the other thing is just look and see if there's any fear there, because fear can be turned around and really help you go through whatever it is there, because it's a very powerful energy, you know. If you can turn that into really looking at your situation rather than trying to, you know, escape it in various ways, is that can really free you from whatever it is that is, you know, making you stick.
I ask myself that question, is this true? You know, mm-hmm. And I think I have some anger, and that comes in because I feel like I've spent years lying to myself in some regards, you know, that no, it isn't true.
You
know, and it's a story that I've been hearing for a long time. But that's an opportunity. It's good, but I get really frustrated, especially as it continues to show up, and then I just work with it.
Yeah. Yeah, and the thing, again, you know, is that most of these so-called negative things, they don't have a finite time. And part of it is just immersing yourself in seeing what you can learn from it, and then have it take whatever time it takes. And in time, as you go through these things, you'll get a better understanding of how long it actually takes. You know, and then as these things reoccur, if they reoccur, is that then you have some more tools on how to deal with it. But the thing for me is, the more I allow myself to experience it, the more tools that I have, not only in dealing with it here, but dealing it with people out there. Because if I don't get those sort of organic tools to develop it, then I'm just teaching, you know, a bunch of pop psych stuff that may work for the odd person here and there. Sounds good that people can try it out, etc. But it doesn't have any real depth for it as a, you know, for dealing with the human condition. There was something else I wanted to say there. Something to do with the frustration. No, it's gone. Maybe it'll come back later. Thanks. But the thing is, you know, it's trusting in yourself that you can do it. And if you do that much, you'll find a way through. Because you have everything that you need, you know. It's there. But sometimes it's like pinball, you know. You're just like being beaten around. But if you have the faith that you'll come through, you will. At some point you'll drop through the slot. Sorry.
There's part of me that thinks that this is the same question, but mm-hmm. There's part of me that thinks that all the questions are the same. So, in listening and learning about Buddhism, you learn that mm-hmm. clinging is the source of suffering. Mm-hmm. And then people kind of throw in this notion of aversion, too.
Yeah, I mean, there's two sides of the same coin. Yeah.
And somebody asked me not too long ago, well, are you satisfied is the question, you know? And mm-hmm. and I thought, well, I don't think I'm supposed to be satisfied. But when mm-hmm. I got to thinking about it, I realized, you know, yeah, I'm really mm-hmm. pretty satisfied with what I'm doing. In that I don't feel like I grasp at things mm-hmm. and want to acquire more. But yeah. then it dawned on me that I have just a tidal wave of aversion.
Yeah.
Pisses me
yeah.
off, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, like, and so, and then I start going, well, I don't want that. And that's probably clinging to some notion of not having aversions. And all.
Yeah. But, well, the important thing is to study that, see how it's going on.
I'm sorry?
Just it's to study that process of aversion, see how it works in your life. It's like the thing, you know, the thing that, again, to going back to that statement of Dogen's, to study the Buddha way is to study the self. So the study of the self is not only, you know, the study of this universe, it's the study of how our own psyche works. So this is how aversion works. Well, I don't want to see so-and-so, so I'm going to sneak around it this way and go around that way. But there's a cost to that, you know? And then what would be the benefit of actually facing up to that person? You know, so you look at the aversions and you see how they work in your life and see what the cost is. And then you feel it, etc. And then you've got something to work with. It's not like you shouldn't have these things, because sometimes aversion is very useful as a human
right.
being, you know?
Well, that's the thing that I get stuck on, because
yeah.
I think that...
Why, do you want
to
be a good Buddhist?
To things that I intend to keep.
Yeah.
I don't... Mm-hmm. There's some stuff I won't eat, you know?
Yeah.
And then I go, well, wait a minute. Now you're turning yourself into an ideologue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I know that there's got to be a catch to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and again, study the effects of those things. And then if there's something where you don't want to face up to something, face up to it. So you've got, you're already good at aversion, see if you can actually face up to it in a different way. You know, because again, freedom is not just, well, I don't need to do this. You know, freedom is that I can do this and I cannot do it.
Right.
Mm. You know, because you see a lot of that fake freedom. Yeah, I can walk away from this, you know. And the thing falls apart, you know. Or you can do both. You've got the freedom to do both of those things. But to study attachment and aversion and see how they work in your life. It's not about being a good Buddhist. I don't think the Buddha even wanted that kind of thing. What he wanted was people to understand their basic nature. You know, and he saw these very ballpark ways. I mean, to put the whole of life into four major movements from suffering to non-suffering, and then to do 8 points on how to live your life is very ballpark. The major reason that he did that kind of thing is that you have these ballpark things and you practice those things and they telescope your life out. You know, so it's not just a matter of holding on to that. Well, I'm good because I'm not attached to this, and I'm not attached, and I don't, you know, avert to that. So I'm a good Buddhist. I'm good. I've got that going for me. But that won't do you any good if you don't try and understand how those things work in your own life. You know, that was the thing that I was thinking of in terms of, is that all of those things where you get mad at your own story, those were protectors in your life at that period of time. They protected you. But now it's different. Now you're seeing through those things. You know, and that's the thing in terms of your own living, is that, you know, like for myself, is I go through seasons where certain things are very important to me. They get mastered. It's important to let them go. But then the important thing is don't beat up on how you were, because now it's different. You have new challenges. So with, you know, attachment and aversion, is that we reach certain points in terms of our own practice. Then it's important to really go into those things and see how they function in terms of one's life. Put a long story short there. But with it is, you know, quite often fear generates a lot of these behaviors that we have in terms of our own life. If that fear arises, it's very strong energy. Be able to really turn that back into the place that you stand and illumine the place that you stand. And do that honestly. You know, if you do that, then practice becomes a lot easier. I don't know if that makes sense.
Can you say that one more time?
If you feel fear, rather than, you know, creating it into a story and believing in it, turn that energy of fear back to illumine the place that you stand. And it will do that. It's a very powerful energy.
I don't quite understand
that. Okay, we'll try it.
What do you mean illumine the place where you stand?
Well, this place. I mean, the fear, quite often, it's a story or it's a feeling. If you, instead of turning the feeling into a story, just really let it illumine or feel the place that you stand.
It.
Yeah.
Just feel the feeling.
Yeah.
Okay.
Hello.
Hey.
I don't know how to properly address you. I apologize, Roshi.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Yeah, that's good. Yeah.
This is my first time here. Mm-hmm. Thank you all for being so welcoming. I had a question about right action.
Yeah.
So, I have not been doing this nearly as long as many people in this room, but I have kind of come to the understanding, kind of along the lines of, I believe the line was, there never was a Bodhi tree,
mm-hmm.
what is there to cling, and learning about the duality and complementariness of all things in life,
mm-hmm.
and the understanding that I've kind of come to is right action thought about as good action or
mm-hmm.
working towards good outcome.
Mm-hmm.
If looked at a certain way, it could be seen as imbalanced.
Yeah, sure.
Because
yeah.
it cannot exist without the complementary bad action.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, both of those are ideas that were created by ego.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just... I've been kind of running myself in circles.
Yeah.
Kind of, well, thinking as I gain more understanding and better practice, like, how can my action actually follow from that to have any sort of purpose?
Yeah, the important thing is to write it in your heart, what really feels right. Because that'll override a lot of the intellectual stuff. You know, if it feels right, then most likely it's right.
Kind of like, if it feels good afterwards. It was more than that.
Well, while you're doing it, you know, I mean, for me, this is a connection between myself and people. If I do things that disturb that connection, you know, there's usually a problem there.
I see that.
So as much as possible, as I try and veer on the side of a positive and, you know, a better outcome rather than, say, causing damage. I mean, sometimes you have to cause damage to sort out a situation.
Mm-hmm.
But then the important thing is to be able to take responsibility for that. You know, it's not just a matter of, oh, I do this and, you know, I screwed up. Then make sure that the amends are made for any of those so-called negative, you know, outcomes. But again, practice is not just about what you think in your head. Is apply these things, see if they work, if they really feel right to you, and then refine it as you go along.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah.
Then we talked about creating a story. I am aware of the fact that I create story, and I don't know if I can stop it, but what I'm doing is I modify the story.
Yeah.
I use my imagination.
Yeah.
If I feel blocked, I imagine a door, and I can imagine how a jellyfish is going through the door, and I imagine very vividly the colors and the movements, and or I can see everything in the music or some kind of a, let's say, a poem.
Yeah.
Then this kind of things works for me very well, rather than rational thinking.
Yeah,
Actually, somebody helps me, even though I'm a therapist, another therapist helps me to think rationally. Mm-hmm. It's not my strength.
Yeah.
I kind of see things like visual. Visualize more than rationalization.
Yeah.
And this is my kind of approach.
Yeah.
It kind of helps me a lot, but I don't think I can stop my story.
Yeah.
And just.
And again, you know. What if it's working for you, that's fine. For me, what happens is quite often the story isn't conducive or isn't matching reality, the reality of the situation. When I find that, say, a part's not matching the situation, then I note it and then go back to the experience of it, because quite often my stories become cyclic. So, you know, I try and put that on side. Off on one side, and try to trust more the body's intuitive way of working with things, because it seems to really work with me. It takes time to drop that story. It took me about 2 years or more to really trust more in the body. It's not that I don't think those things through. I do that as a pointer to start off with, and then I return to that until I get more information, and then maybe I'll bring the story up again, then I'll put it on one side.
Then what about the body? What do you feel in the body?
I feel lots of things. You know, it's like when I meet somebody, is that I just sense how that person is. You know, how somebody says something, how they posture their body, the look in the face, their eyes, teaches you a lot, and that's all direct information. You know, and then I feel whatever's there, and then, you know, then it changes, something else comes in. So communication, you know, it's like somebody's telling me a lie quite often. I feel it in my gut, you know.
It is so interesting because it's confidence. I also feel
it. Yeah.
At least I tell myself maybe it's not true what I feel.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's that aspect, and all of the years of the intellectual aspects too. That also gives another part to it. But what I'm saying, you know, as a pointer, you can't just keep on trusting in the intellectual aspect. The more instinctive aspect has to be developed too. You know, and then in time that integration really comes in, where you're using the whole thing. But usually as human beings, is we rely way too much on the intellect, which isn't a complete experience. You know, and the reason that I usually say put the intellect on one side is that we're really good with that already. But the instinctive and intuitive part needs to be raised up to match. And that's one of the things that Zen practice does over time, is that then that instinctive direct experience then is the basis, and the intellect is the way that the expression really comes out, which seems to me to be a much better way of living life. You know, but it's not a fait accompli. There's that development that goes on, you know, but I'm talking from this place right now. Thank you. Okay, last question.
Hi, thank you. I'm new as well, thank you. And I'm dealing with the inner judge and the outer judge, and wondering about how, and specifically how to relate to or deal with other people's expectations.
Of you?
And judgments, yes.
Of you?
Yes.
Well, you know, take it. See if it's useful, see if there's any truth to it, and if it isn't, drop it. If there is something there, then try something new out, see what you can do. It's not that you shouldn't judge things, it's that naturally as human beings we judge things, but the trouble is it begins to spread over the whole sphere. You know, we're even judging, you know, if somebody's hair's parted on the right side or whatever, you know, it's just so meticulous. The thing is that you can leave it aside and just experience the world, you know, which will reduce the amount that judge comes in. It's just nice if that judge can come up when it's, you know, when it's needed to judge things. But don't let that, you know, that judge sort of just turn in on yourself and start eroding your own confidence. That's, you know, that really isn't a good thing to do.
And when it comes from the outside, again, you don't want to turn it against yourself, you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, look and see if there's any truth in it. You know, that's one of those things, is just look and see. If it feels right, then maybe do something about it. If not, throw it away.
And the emotion is a good guide to whether there's truth there.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to look at it a bit broader than that too. Each one of us has our own patterns. You know, so part of it again is just really look at it, seeing if I have behaved in a certain way for a long period of time, just try something slightly different, and then see if there's an effect there, because certain things become taboo in terms of one's own life. Like if you're used to criticism, you've always been criticized, that's the way that you'll take the world. But you can always, you know, take it in a different way too, is that, okay, that's criticism. I don't need to embody it or anything like that. I'll just take it, carry on with my life. Because some people, they've been criticized so much, is that when it's not there, then they have to take it over themselves, you know. Been there, done that. So it's not quite so simple on that way, but look and see if there's some alternatives, because that so-called judging can really spread to all parts of your, you know, of your existence. And again, is that, you know, a lot of these things, they take years to actually experiment with. The main thing is look at how those things feel and see if you can put something different into place. Right, let's finish. Sentient beings are nonetheless